This podcast is brought to you by the Early Career Club, a community of peers acting as a professional onboarding prospect research department. Welcome to Research Rocks, a podcast for early career prospect research professionals. I'm Jennifer Filla. Today, I'm talking with Jessica Balsam, Director of Prospect Management at the University of Washington.
Hello, Jessica. Thank you for joining me on Research Rocks today.
Thanks, Jen. I'm happy to be here.
I am really excited to talk to you about prospect management, but I thought before we jump right in, it'd be really neat to find out how did you get involved in the field of prospect research and how did you land in prospect management?
Yeah, great. I'm always happy to share this story because it starts with me being an artist and deciding that I needed to get a real job. And I was a glassblower. And so I would do, you know, people would hire me. I was a glassblower for hire. And I just thought, you know, I need to have a regular job. So I went to my local art museum and asked if I could volunteer. And of course, I thought I was a student, but I was well out of college by that time. And I learned all the basic office-y stuff that, you know, like, oh, that there are big hanging folders and the little folders go inside them, things like that, that I never had known because I had never had an office job before. And while I was at it, they put me in development because that's where they needed the most help. So I learned that development was a career and a profession. And, you know, it being an art museum that didn't pay very much, people are always turning over. And within 6 months of me volunteering, somebody had left. And I happened to be the annual fund database manager type of person. So I interviewed and got the permanent job. And one of my first tasks was to do a huge a conversion of how we coded all of our GIFs. And so that was my first real idea that I love systems thinking and data. And I know people still say to me, like, wow, you're an artist. How do you do this? Like, what, that seems like a totally different skill. But to me, it's all the same, seeing the big picture and how things are going to interact with each other. So I had a great time working there. And I also, in about 4 years, I got an offer to go do just prospect research, prospect management at a small college called the Evergreen State College. So I took that job, and that really introduced me to the world of APRA and the amazing colleagues that APRA has. And I started serving on my local chapter board, APRA Northwest. And that, I think, was really what cemented in my mind that I wanted to make this my career. I think prior to that, I thought, you know, there's a lot of things you can do in development and with data. Knowing that I had this amazing group of people that had my back and I could go to for best practices, it was the thing that really made me think, like, wow, I could stick with this. And I worked there for about 4 years as well, and then got the offer to come to University of Washington, where I get to focus on prospect management only and lead a team of prospect management. So kind of too good to turn down. Though I do love prospect research and the other areas, it's really a blessing to be able to focus on just one area of prospect development. But I have this great memory and a very warm feeling when I think about one person shops and people, you know, like I was, where I was trying to fit a tiny bit of prospect research and prospect management into a day where I was also managing the annual fund, writing all the acknowledgement letters, helping with grant writing, handling file folders like a pro. So that's my background.
That's pretty neat. And it's interesting to hear the timeline, you know, the 4 years, mm-hmm. and that kind of progression, because it does take time.
Yeah.
It takes time to learn and to get settled and to discover what it is you like best when you wear all the hats. Well, which one in particular do you like?
Yeah, exactly. And I've been here for about 7 years. I don't want to give people the impression that I change jobs every 4 years.
Well, you're growing.
Right.
You're growing. And now you're at a large institution, so there's room probably to grow within it.
Yep.
So now you're in prospect management solely. You're leading a team. What does that look like? What do you do in prospect management?
Yeah, for us at University of Washington, it's a lot about helping our 200 frontline fundraisers. So just let that sink in for a minute, helping them figure out how to focus, how to prioritize their work, and how to share it with our system, our database. And then reporting back to them on how they're doing against their metrics. So we really see ourselves as partners with them in trying to help them share their information about what they're, how they're interacting with donors so that University of Washington can maximize their those donors' philanthropic investment and really make a difference here at University of Washington. So it's pretty rewarding. We have a really great culture of, you know, us being able to design our own prospect management system and maintain it, and even conceiving our own, you know, reports and advising on what the metrics should be, and that the leaders really take it from there in terms of, you know, setting the expectations and the stage for the fundraisers.
Wow. So what does that mean? Do you meet one-on-one with the frontline fundraisers? Do you have regular group meetings? Like, what does it look like in a day?
Yeah, so since we have 19 people in prospect management and research, we have decided to divide ourselves up on a client basis. So each of my three prospect management team have a set number of clients that they work with. Out of those 200 fundraisers, they're assigned to about 40 of them. And similar with the researchers. So the research, there are 10 researchers, and they each get a bucket of clients to work with too. So that each client has a prospect researcher and a prospect tracker or a prospect management person assigned to help them. And it starts with training. It starts with the minute they come on board. So as soon as they learn the basics of the database, then someone from my team comes and gives them their onboarding about, you know, what are our expectations? What is our prospect management policy? We have a little bit of a different policy here than a lot of other big institutions in that we have open cultivation, which means any fundraiser can contact any prospective donor, so that we hope to maximize that donor's investment in the area that they're interested in. And so the way we let them find that out is by talking to as many development officers as want to talk to them. So that takes a lot of onboarding. And with that great power of being able to contact any prospective donor comes the great responsibility of sharing their information about those contacts with the system and with their colleagues. And then once a person is onboarded, then we start meeting with them at least quarterly to talk about their portfolio. And that is where the researcher and the prospect management person go as a team and sit down one-on-one for half an hour with the fundraiser and just review mostly their top prospects, the ones that they're going to ask this year, this fiscal year. We call that their top 25. So we talk a lot about their top 25 and how they're progressing with their top 25. And we just answer questions for them. You know, I have this person, I think that, you know, I talked to them about their estate, and I talked to them about what it would look like to make an estate commitment. I gave them some language. Would you call that a proposal? Should I open a proposal? Should I not? What stage should it be in? That's what those meetings are really for. Then in between the meetings, they're maintaining their portfolio and their proposals, and we're available, you know, to answer questions, but a lot of the work they do themselves. But, you know, they ask us questions at those meetings, like, how do I look compared to my peers? Or do you think I have too many people in my portfolio? Could you do some analysis about the ones that I should take out or new people to put in? And so it's really a time for us to listen and determine what they might need from us in terms of services, and then go back and provide that. So it's a real, it's a bit of a roller coaster ride. Every year we meet at the end of the quarter with most of our 200 fundraisers. And then between the quarters, we do all the cool projects that we talked about with them. Like, oh, I did this analysis of how much you overlap with this other person, or, you know, a lot of that stuff. And then before we know it, the quarterly meetings are upon us again. And it's super fun.
Wow. Open cultivation. That's heretic. It's just crazy and wonderful. And so even though they can contact anyone and, of course, have great responsibility for properly stewarding and cultivating, how do they still have their own portfolio?
That's right.
Is that right?
Yeah, so they can be assigned to a number of prospects, and we have guidelines like everybody does about how many prospects should be in their portfolio. And most of our fundraisers do a good job of staying within that. But anybody else could also be assigned to that prospect. The only exceptions we make are for principal gift prospects. And we have approximately 120 of those. So other than that, anybody can put any prospect in their portfolio. Once the prospect is under solicitation, then they get a relationship manager, and that person has to be the air traffic controller about, okay, who's going to ask, at what time, what do we think is the right ask at the right amount. But before they're in solicitation, they're just in a bunch of portfolios. And what we find is that the donors can really handle it, right? You think that, oh, yeah, it's too much, but the donors are usually happy to be contacted by the areas that they're interested in. And if they're not interested, then there's no point in continuing, right, contacting them, because there are lots of other, we have, you know, more than 20,000 identified prospects. And so there's a lot of other fish in the sea for them to go try to talk to.
So I was wondering about that. How do prospects get identified, and then how do they get assigned to a gift officer?
Right. The prospects are being identified mostly by the research team. And so they do all kinds of analysis, data mining. We have some algorithms that look at people who are rising in velocity, RFM, things like that. But they're also doing the good old-fashioned publication review, you know, somebody who's been mentioned in Business Journal. And so we're constantly adding prospects. And then when we add the prospect, we add as many areas of interest as possible. So we have, I think it's 29 possible areas of interest at the UW, ranging from, you know, University of Washington Medicine to one of our independent radio stations. And we don't assign a primary. So it's just, you know, did they graduate from this college? Did their spouse graduate from this college? Did they donate in a significant way? Have they donated to outside organizations that have a similar mission? So the researchers have the tough job of making sure they're adding all of those unit interests. And once they get added to a unit interest, then they're in that unit's pool. And that's a great way for, we have some reports that show newly added prospects to your pool. And so if fundraisers are looking, then they can find, oh, this newly added $1 million prospect, I will put them in my portfolio. So we have a strong philosophy of the fundraiser gets to pick who goes in their portfolio. And they have a web form that they use to add prospects to their portfolio. But a lot of times it's very personalized service from my team. You know, the researcher might say, hey, I think you might be really interested in this prospect, and email them directly. And then they'll email back and say, great, please put them in my portfolio. And then we don't say, okay, go use the web form, right? We'll just do that for you. Kind of thing. So.
Right.
So it works.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, so let's say surfaces this wonderful new prospect for whatever reason, they rise to the top in terms of indicators, and it gets assigned to a pool. And maybe, you know, you and the researcher sit down with a gift officer you think makes a lot of sense for that and say, this is a great person for you. But the person doesn't get contacted. Like how, I mean, I know we want the gift officer to be empowered, right? Of course. I mean, they're going to do their best job that way. But sometimes you get a new gift officer maybe, or someone less trained, they're a little more nervous about discovery visits. How do you make sure that doesn't happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem everywhere, right? I think one of the main things we try to do is not give them too many new prospects at once. We've all heard of decision fatigue, and decision fatigue is real. So more than, let's say, three great new prospects at a time are a lot less likely to get contacted. It also has to do with where you are in campaign. So we noticed at the end of our last campaign around 2008 that people were not doing discovery work at all. And you know, we were throwing all these new leads at them, and they just weren't. We looked at what we call saturation rates for, you know, for each unit, how many of their prospects had they contacted in the last 5 years, and they were, saturation rates were way down at like 20% on average. But we also took a step back then and said, look, we're at the end of at that time, a $2.5 billion campaign. I think people are probably trying to finish out the campaign with the prospects they know, which is smart. But we alerted our leadership, hey, this is going to be something that we're going to need to address in the inter-campaign period. So they were all about it. Leadership was very excited, and they worked with us to conceive what we ended up calling the Discovery Challenge, where we just pushed out all of those undiscovered prospects, meaning any prospect that hadn't been contacted in a significant way in the last 5 years by each unit, pushed out lists to them and just said, please try to contact as many of these as you can. And the guideline, I think, was every fundraiser was expected to contact 4 of them each week. And we had a weekly contest. So the Discovery Challenge, I think, ran for 6 months. Now, this has been since 2010, so I'm not going to remember all the exact details, but I believe we had 10,000 discoverable prospects. And I think we contacted, I should have looked up all the details. We contacted a lot of them over the course of the 6 months, and we had a trophy for the individual fundraiser that contacted the most each week. And then we had a trophy for the team that contacted the most each month. And then that trophy was traveling. And we had like craft moments where we decided since it was cold calling that our penguin should be our mascot. So each of the trophies had a little penguin standing on an ice cube. People got really into it. And one of the things that came up during that Discovery Challenge was that some of the fundraisers were just a little rusty, right? Because they had just been in this campaign. But some of them had never really worked on that muscle of discovery. So what ended up happening is our student calling program started having training nights. And it's super cool because it's a really cool leadership opportunity for the students. They get to train the frontline fundraisers on how to make cold calls. And the fundraisers show up with a list of, I think they said, a minimum of 300 prospects that they want to discover. And they load them into the student calling software. And then they get the headphone and they get the screen, and they do it in the evening when people are more likely to be at home. And the student callers train them on how to get people to pick up the phone, when they pick up the phone, how to get them to engage in talking and chatting, because it's pretty different skill from closing a $1 million gift. And that really helped. And what happened then too is that people ended up disqualifying a lot of prospects, which is super helpful. And we had to really push our messaging from the research shop that we are not going to be offended if you disqualify a prospect. We're pushing a lot of leads your way. And, you know, of course, we think they're all good or we wouldn't be sending them to you. But we acknowledge that there's only so much we can know from behind the computer screen about this prospect. And so if there are things that you know and you have given it, you're the college try, and you decided that this is not a good prospect for your unit, then move on, because we have a lot of other prospects to talk to. And I think almost every organization is in that situation nowadays. Like 10 years ago, probably 20 years ago, finding a $1 million prospect was a huge deal, and everybody would drop everything to contact that prospect, as they should have. But now we have hundreds and hundreds of $1 million prospects. And so just our scale at UW is huge, but translate that to another organization where you have, you know, well, let's say you have a whole bunch of $100,000 prospects. It's the same thing. You have to focus on the ones that are most likely. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to do major gift work.
That's so true. I love how you made it into a game.
Yeah.
Who doesn't like a game? Right. And then it identified a training need, which is, I know when I was a major gift officer, briefly, I was bad at it. I didn't know what to do. I had no idea how to move someone from step one to step two. I easily felt uncomfortable in the room. And so, you know, I knew I was making them uncomfortable. But when I left, I did go out and get some training, and it's just made a huge difference in terms of sales for me. So, yeah, like cold calls, discovery calls, even when they're donors, that's intimidating.
Yeah. I think sometimes people don't know what they need training in too until you shine a light on it. Yeah, and I think a lot of funny cultivate people and steward them, but I don't think a lot of them had had specific training on how to discover and qualify new prospects. So.
I think that's common. I think it's a gap.
Yeah.
I have recently seen more training opportunities on that subject, but previously no.
Yeah.
So you can go at it like a bull in a china shop and just pick up the phone and call, but you're not getting a success rate that you want from that, and the donors aren't getting the experience you want from that.
Right.
As we know from all those solicitation calls, right?
Yes, exactly.
When the for-profit companies were doing them and poorly in the UK, that was a big problem. So doing discovery calls right is a big deal.
Yeah, I should add too that our messaging was really strong around it. This is every major gift officer's responsibility to do discovery. But at some point, the message might have gotten a little diluted because what happened was most of the units then decided that they needed a discovery officer. And so a lot of discovery officers have been hired since the discovery challenge. And we were like, well, that wasn't exactly what we meant, because now we're struggling with approximately 20 discovery officer positions that are sort of hard to define what success looks like for them, because they, what do? Do they pass great prospects on to other major gift officers, or do they keep them themselves? And if so, at what level is it appropriate for them to be soliciting? However, it has been a great training ground for new NGOs. So I don't want to say it's been a bad thing. It was just an unintended consequence on the part of the discovery challenge.
That is so interesting. Yes, because now you get to train them yourselves,
right.
Which is good.
Right.
Wow, interesting. Well, I know people struggle, especially in the smaller shops where there is less training for gift officers who may be the chief development officer. I'm running everything. And so, a discovery call is going to fall way down on the list of things to do.
Right.
It's just not as fun as calling on a donor who's ready to make a gift.
Yeah.
So there's just that. So when you're, as you've worked, especially in the larger office, as you work in prospect management, what do you think the gift officers find most challenging about prospect management?
Yeah, there's a spectrum. There are some people who want the system to do more for them than it does. They want to put their annual fund asks. They want to be able to track those. They want to be able to track every steward. They want to track and have goals for every stewardship meeting they have, or stewardship piece that they put together. They want to track, the number of donor events they have and have goals around that. So I think some fundraisers get so excited about the robust prospect management system that we have here with its goals and metrics and reports that they want to show all of their work in it. And that's always a tough conversation that we have, where we say to them, like, if we measured stewardship contacts, then people would start having more stewardship contacts, and that's not really the end goal, right? Of course you have to steward your donors, but what we measure here is number of major gift asks and at what level, because that's the end goal, right? So we measure that as a proxy for all that other work you're doing. And they say, but how do I report the manager then when I don't have this beautiful report? And we have to say to them, that you have to write that, write a narrative or put it in your performance review, track it in some other way. I think that we have a bit of a minimalist philosophy about metrics and reports here. And so I think some gift officers struggle because they want to have a report that just spits out, here's everything that you've done this year. And then you have people on the other end of the spectrum where they find it really hard to share their information on contact reports and proposals because they run out of time. And I can appreciate that. I'm a deadline-oriented person too. I actually, like you, have been on donor visits before, which I think is a really valuable experience. And I know how hard it is to take that huge visit and distill it down into a readable, usable contact report. So we are constantly trying to, provide training and support around contact reports and making sure that it's as easy as possible to file them. We have a web form where fundraisers can file them. And then the web form copies all the other fundraisers who are working with that prospect. So that's another way we uphold open cultivation. But, you have some people that just, they struggle with getting their information into the database. So I think one of the things that we are often reminding them is it's the relationship's not with you, it's with the institution. And it's just really important that you at least hit on the high points of whatever meeting you had so that we can track that for your future colleagues.
Sure. Yeah. In my experience as a business donor, and I have an assistant and I have a CRM, and I still have a bad habit sometimes of just typing it in a Word document and putting it on my desktop. I'm like, I'll put it in later.
Yeah.
Bad move.
Right. This to be filed, and it just, it builds up.
And then I get the phone call and I have no idea what's going on. So, yeah.
You're searching on your computer for the web, for the Word doc. Like, what was it that we talked about?
It's amazing because they're, what size is a typical portfolio for a guest officer?
About 100 prospects, and those are householded.
Okay. Even 100 people, that's 100 people who are not your family, friends, staff members, and you're supposed to remember everything about them. I was never good at that. So, I need that boost. I need to be able to quickly go online and check it out as I'm on the phone.
Doesn't it just, if you sit back and think about it, it just puts you in awe of what the fundraisers do every day. Like, I'm just like, I'm like classic about calling people the wrong names or, you gotta think about like the fact that they have to remember how to pronounce the names and what the kids' names are. I mean, that's just, it's amazing.
And they can go into a room at some event that may or may not be work-related, and they'll recognize the person, put them in context, and remember their kids and pets' names. Like, oh my gosh, and that they went on a trip. I am in awe of those people. They amaze me.
Exactly.
They deserve their success.
Exactly.
So let's see. Let's talk a little bit about, what it takes to create a program. So lots of people early in their career in prospect research, where they're doing multiple things, like maybe the only researcher, they're often walking into, we have a prospect management system, but we have no idea how that works. So can you do that? Or we don't have anything and we know we should be doing that. We want to start a major gifts initiative. Do you have any suggestions about how to get started? What do you start with?
Yeah, I think that one of the, I love this stuff, by the way. I'm always talking with small shops around Upper Northwest area and just trying to help them get started, because somebody did that for me when I was at the small art museum. And it was just so, so useful, because I think a lot of times what you hear is about the super, super fancy systems like UW's, which has been in place for 20 years. And then you get really overwhelmed by but where do I start? I think that the most important information that we gather in a prospect management system is the contact reports. because that is where the meat is that goes between the bread and butter that of the prospect management system. It's where you're going to look to see what is our interaction with this person been like. What have we talked to them about? You know, how have we tried with this person? So having a robust contact report system and culture is probably the most important place to start if you're thinking about starting prospect management system. And you know, that's hard. It's hard to get sometimes an executive director on board if it's a small nonprofit and you're talking about a person who's already doing the jobs of five people. But a lot of times it's up to us to manage up and create that, you know, create the leader that we want to see for our prospect management shops. And, you know, whatever that looks like in your shop could be, you know, I'm producing a report every week of all the contact reports that have been filed. And people are like, okay, I guess I better file my reports. Or, hey, I just want to remind you, I saw that you had a meeting this week on your calendar. Could I work with your executive assistant to make sure that we get those filed as contact reports? That can be probably one of the most useful legacies that you will leave for your organization if you have a great contact report system. Other than that, I think it's a really good idea to start using a prospect flag if you aren't already in your database or your Excel sheet, whatever you're using to track your donors or your members. It's really nice to just start using, you know, almost every database has some kind of field that you can hijack to say, yes, the person is a major prospect or no, they're not. And you can just do a yes, no for, you know, a couple of years until you start having formers. And then you're going to add a former code to be like, okay, they were, but now we decided they're not. And you can, that way you can use the term as loosely or as tightly as you want to, you know, whatever constitutes a major gift prospect for your organization. And maybe you don't have time to research and see exactly how many assets they have, but that's okay. I mean, it's really more just about like, we have a gut feeling that this person is going to be super important and might be able to invest in a meaningful way through a personalized interaction with our organization. And so we're going to flag them, and that way we'll stay focused. I think a lot of times small nonprofits need to make the shift from like they're so overwhelmed recognizing and stewarding their current members and donors that they forget about the stewarding and cultivating the potential donors. And so having a flag can make it super easy to just be like, hey, you're sending out an invitation for this event. Please include the major gift prospects too. And it's a tough shift because people start to say, oh, but they haven't earned it because they're not a director's club member or whatever it is. And you're going to have to be like, yeah, but we're never going to get them there if we don't give them this opportunity to, you know, mingle and meet, and, you know, rub shoulders with our other current members and donors. So, you know, if you have the flag, you can kind of hit that on the fly a bit too, you know, including them in events and opportunities is going to be a great way to start cultivating them towards a major gift, because it's not like you're going to be able to necessarily do that all in, you know, individually. So you're going to have to be able to tag them as a group in some way. So I think contact reports and the prospect flag are my top two places to start. And once you get past that and you're like, oh, I've done all that, what's next? Then you contact APRA and you contact Prospect Research Institute and you say, I need some more ideas.
Great. Well, what I heard you say was a culture of doing contact reports, which is huge and hard to do. Some executive directors just won't. They'll say sure, and it never happens. So if you can get there, and then creating some kind of flag so that we know this person is a prospect. And a lot of people now are beginning to realize, when I research someone, I need to put something on the record as well so I can show what I've done. And we can track that research is effective. But also, being the team player and making it a culture of major gifts. So talking to that events person and saying, hey, let's invite them and here's why. That's great. I hadn't thought about that broader culture, because that's an issue, mm-hmm. for sure. I've seen it. And you wouldn't think, because they're all working as a team, right? And it's only like 9 people in the whole office, but they're working on their own thing.
Yeah.
Great.
People are trying to protect their own time, which you can't blame them for, right? At a small nonprofit.
Yeah, it's enough, right? I mean, you're working really hard and then someone wants you to do something else.
Right.
That's their job. Like, wait a minute. But you're right. Yeah, well, that's that culture of philanthropy, but we're not going to go there.
That's a bigger question, right?
Yes. Well, another, at the end too, there you were also saying, and when you're ready for more, and a lot of early career professionals, you know, it might be year 2 or 3, or they're in a college situation, and they're being pressured for more. Like, what metrics should we be using? Things like that. And you mentioned reaching out to places like ABRA, and the Institute for different programs. What about mentors? Like, everyone says, get a network, get a mentor. I looked at your LinkedIn profile and I saw a recommendation from someone that you mentored. How does that happen? You know, that can seem daunting for someone who's behind a screen and needs to make a mentor relationship. Whoa.
Yeah, it's true.
What's your experience?
That very, very lovely mentee of mine was set up through a formal process through my chapter. So Upper Northwest has had a mentorship program going on, more than 10 years now, where when you sign up to join, you can check a box that says, I would like to be assigned a mentor, or I would like to be assigned as a mentor. And it's there's a person on the board whose role it is to make the matches and check in with them and kind of set the stage for what is expected between a mentor and mentee relationship. It's expected to be maybe about a 6-month time period where hopefully you meet in person, maybe once a month or so. This person in particular was too far away geographically for me to meet in person. I think we only met one time, but we set up regular phone calls, and it was just super rewarding. So I've done a number of those formal mentor relationships. And when I talk to people in the community, which I do because I try to do presentations at our local AFP chapter or places where they might not have heard of APRA, then I always end up making a plug for you should join the chapter because this free mentorship program exists. And that's how we end up drawing in a lot of mentors too. It's like, oh, I'm going to join the chapter just so I can get the mentorship. But what we are also doing now in Upper Northwest, I should say we, because I'm not on the board anymore, but one of my employees is on the board and she is the mentorship chair, and she has started this thing that's called a networker. So maybe you can't commit to a 6-month period as a mentor, or you don't want to commit to a 6-month period as a mentee, then you can just sign up as a networker. And this is just one meeting for coffee or one phone call, where you have some specific questions and you want to talk to somebody more seasoned and just, you know, like you're saying, should I have metrics? Should I not? I keep hearing about metrics. What should I do about that? I'm a small shop. Do I need to have them? You know, just bounce something off somebody without necessarily, you know, wading in knee deep for the whole mentorship relationship. So that's, you know, through your chapter is a great way to do that. And if your chapter doesn't offer it, then, you know, I think people are very open to people reaching out on LinkedIn and asking for just, you know, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And I recently had somebody who asked if she could buy me coffee and then showed up with like really cool swag from her organization. Here's some bookmarks. I know you have kids, so I brought you some temporary tattoos. And I was like, well, that sweetens the deal. That was very, very, very nice. Not required, of course. But, you know, I always find it really fascinating to learn about these other organizations and chat with people. So I would say you just don't hesitate to reach out to anybody who you think is doing the thing that you want to do in your organization.
Well, you show some great indicators of being open to networking because you make presentations, you've been a mentor, your LinkedIn profile is active. So I guess we could use our research skills.
That's right.
Identify people. Yeah. And we usually have, you know, most APRA chapters, even like Florida for me, we're the entire state, and there really aren't that many researchers in my specific area, but it's still a list. And I can go and call those people, and you're right, people are very open. I've done the same thing. I've never had a formal mentor program, but totally raid the member list and call people I feel that I want to get to know better.
And most chapters do have that kind of geographic challenge. I think we thought we were the only ones in Northwest for a while, but you hear that from almost every chapter. Like, oh, we're kind of spread out. And so, you know, hopefully your chapter is supportive of distance learning and phone calls. And if they're not, then maybe you can push them to provide those kind of services for their far-flung members, you know?
Wait. You could join the board.
Exactly.
They're always looking for board members. If you're willing to volunteer. Well, it's been wonderful to hear what you're doing. Some really, really good tips for people starting out. I'm wondering, before we end it, is there anything, any last thing you'd like to share?
Well, I always have to put a plug in for my leg of the three-legged stool, that is prospect development. I think that a lot of times we use the word research to mean anything in prospect development, and we don't have a great name for our profession anymore, right? It used to be very simple. We would call it prospect research, and now it's like, well, but we have analytics, we have prospect management in there. And whether or not you love the term prospect development, some people love it, some people don't. It's definitely not as simple as research. But I think nomenclature is important. And I think that selling your own skills is important. And so two things I think come to mind about recommendations. One is, don't forget about prospect management, because you could do all the research in the world and you could spend 4 hours making the most beautiful profile. But if you don't have a system to track who's contacting whom and what the ratings are and how many prospects you have and what progress you're making, then you're not going to be able to prove that this work is adding value to your organization. So prospect management is the part of the pie that is going to allow you to say, look, we had 200 prospects. We contacted X percentage of them. We're working towards, building major gift culture in our organization. And here's the steps that we know will lead to that, because boards will want to know, and your executive director will want to know, if you're going to make an investment in this, how is it going to pan out? And at what point is it going to pan out? So that's where prospect management can come in really strong. Chances are you're already, a lot of people are already doing this work and they're just calling it prospect research. And so of course it's not important that you go educate everybody about what prospect management is. But I think sometimes putting a name to it makes it something that you remember and value in your organization. Another thing that I've been on a kick about lately, and this is related, is doing an elevator speech for yourself. So I did a presentation on this at our chapter conference a couple months ago. And it is surprisingly hard to craft an elevator speech for a lot of us in the industry whose jobs are, in my case, very niche, or whose jobs are very broad. It's very easy, I think, easier if you're a prospect researcher to just say, I look for highly capable, wealthy people who might have the capacity to make a major investment in our organization so that, my fundraisers can focus on the people with the most capacity. But what do you say when it gets into prospect management and analytics and other types of services? So it's worth it to practice an elevator speech so that, what if you get a new director of education or programs at your organization who has never heard of this profession before, and you have their attention for, let's say, 20 seconds. Maybe you're literally in an elevator, maybe you're not. What do you say that makes it clear, without putting too much jargon in, makes it clear what kind of value you bring to the organization?
All right. I'm going to ask Jessica. So what do you do?
I knew you were going to ask, and I'm so embarrassed to say that I don't have a well-practiced elevator. So I'm on the advocacy committee for EPRA, and this is something that we are working on, putting together a toolkit for people to advocate for themselves. And I feel very passionate about people advocating for themselves, because I think that it not only raises your own personal boat, but all boats when you say, hey, I think I deserve a better title. I think I deserve, you know, some kind of recognition. I think I deserve to stop doing event bios because my time could be spent more wisely. Whatever it is that you would like to do or stop doing, you do that for yourself, and you are adding value to your organization, but you're also setting an example for your peers in APRA. And so the elevator speech part of it only came to me recently. And I will give like the gist of what I usually say, which is I usually start with contact reports, to be honest, because that's something that everybody can relate to. So I help fundraisers share their information about what they're talking to prospective donors about with the database, so that we can go back later and say, where is this person interested in? Where are they not interested in? And we can preserve that prospect's relationship with the UW for posterity. And we can at some point then find their passion area and maximize their giving. And we can't do that if we don't have a robust system to help people share that data with the organization. And then if I have more time, then I'll start talking about helping fundraisers know what the expectations are for their job and where they're at with their metrics, and tracking the top campaign proposals for our current campaign so that we can make sure we're successful with our $5 billion goal.
That's big number.
And, you know, it's a big job to make sure that all those proposals stay up to date and as accurate as possible, so that when the president of the university or the foundation board comes calling, I can say with some level of certainty, we have X number of proposals in the pipeline at X dollar that we hope will result in X number of dollars. I mean, that's what it comes down to, is being able to project and help your organization move forward with a successful campaign.
Well, that's great. A little bit of branding. It's all good.
Right.
It's very clear. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today, Jessica. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
That was Jessica Balsam, Director of Prospect Management at the University of Washington. And you heard her. Get yourself branded and keep rocking the research.